Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today I've got a guest from the University of Kansas, and she's in that sort of general area of what I would call bioanalytical science. Her name is Susan Lunty, and we're going to find out what makes Susan tick and what's good about bioanalytical science. Susan, welcome to Science Studio.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. Yeah.
Well, this is going to be a lot of fun. I say that every week, and every week it turns out to be a lot of fun. But before we get on to what you do, what bioanalytical is and all that good stuff and why it's important, let's talk a little bit about Susan. How did you get into this business of science in the first place?
Well, I always really liked science. Even as a pretty young kid, my dad was sort of an engineering type. And I remember specifically he enrolled me in a geology course when I was like 8 or 9, where we went and looked at fossils. And I just enjoyed nature. When I was in third or fourth grade, my grandfather had gotten me a subscription to Ranger Rick Nature magazine, so we started a little Ranger Rick Science Club in I think fourth grade, and we had one of our teachers took us on all these field trips,
and
we
looked up about
monocots and dicots. This was in Detroit,
Detroit
area,
so
yeah, but
Michigan,
we were in Ann Arbor, yeah,
right,
near,
oh,
we
lovely.
Went to the museums in Ann Arbor, and actually, I think the fossils were in Windsor, over in Canada.
So you had to go abroad to
find the nearest fossil. It was a lot easier then. And then when I went to high school, I was really fascinated with chemistry. And my uncle, he was a professor at Notre Dame, and whenever we'd go to South Bend, he would take me and show me his labs, and he was more in the psychophysics area, where it was most of his labs were more looking at perception and things like that. And so it was just really cool to see the science of perception and all that. So was
that a sort of a research project with lots of volunteer students?
He'd have students go in there, and
right.
And he'd have all these different things to look at, how people different people perceive different patterns and things compared to other people. So it was pretty interesting. I don't know a lot about it, but he was also a role model in terms of probably part of the reason why I sort of ended up in academics eventually.
Because you thought he had a nice career and an interesting
sort of
attitude towards what he could see around him. So he had an impact upon your perception of science.
Yes, definitely. And he was actually a chemistry major as an undergrad, but then he moved to Harvard and went into psychology. So
it's amazing just how many people start out doing chemistry and move out of it. And that's not because chemistry is odious, that they have to move away. But it's sort of, we call it, well, maybe you did too, the central science.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's a little bit of math, there's a little bit of doing things in laboratory, you know, experimental. Those can be used in many different areas.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I've seen a lot of my students that have graduated go to the pharmaceutical industry, and they end up being managers, actually, because they're problem solvers and they can look at a broad base of different aspects of a problem, including chemistry.
Right.
And then interact among, you know, marketing and the people in the lab and the biologists. So,
but anyway, but your uncle was the role model in a sense.
He was a role model, definitely. And then I went to Wayne State for 1 year and then moved to Kalamazoo College. But in my undergrad, I did a couple of research internships at Wayne State Medical School. And you were asking me earlier about what those were. One was with this immunologist called Dr. Lightbody. And he was, I was only a sophomore at the time, but he was looking at the immune system, and we would isolate spleens from little mice. And that was sort of my first foray into animal research.
You stuck with it. I think if my first experience in science had been spleens of little mice, I'd have been in the art department.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we did that, and then that was just a sophomore thing. And then in my senior year, I had to do a senior thesis, so I worked with a guy named Dr. Hudson. And there we did organic chemistry and tried to develop some analogs and neurotransmitters for they were based on some snake venom.
There's a lot of interesting things that come out of snake venom.
Yeah, there are.
I've heard many lectures, actually, about this, and the number of different components.
Yeah.
You know, one component to sort of anesthetize the area where the bite is.
Right.
So you don't feel so uptight about it, and then they inject something else, and no, nonstop.
Right.
But we don't have time to get into
that. No, you're right. There's a tremendous, and just natural products in general. I'm in the pharmacy school as well, and there's several faculty members that take natural substances and just try and modify it so it's easier to deliver in a formulation, a pill or an injection. So there's definitely a huge wealth
formulation of drugs. That is, okay, there's an active species,
right?
But it's how you package it.
Right.
And I've always thought, well, the generics that would be the same.
No,
but
they're
I've
not.
Got friends who take certain medications, and when they went to the generic, even though all modern science tells you the two active ingredients are the same, but the matrix they come in has a big impact upon their efficacy.
It's super important.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know that until relatively recently.
Yeah, it's super. They're supposed to be able to show that it has the same efficacy and is basically the same dissolution profile, which would mean it dissolves in your stomach at the same rate as the parent drug. But you're correct. A lot of the generics are not quite up to par
we'll find out in the future how that goes, because more and more health costs are so high, and nobody wants to pay for it, government included, so that, you know, the cost of the drug is going to come down, which might mean, I don't say cutting corners because that sounds bad, but not quite that same concern for the public or the patient, I suppose.
Right.
Anyway, let's talk about bioanalytical
chemistry.
Yeah, what you do. Tell us, as a bioanalytic chemist, what does that mean, or bioanalytic scientist?
So it's a combination of analytical chemistry, which is measurements of chemicals in different systems, and biology. So what my group does is we focus on measuring biomarkers and neurotransmitters, compounds that do something in the body, also drugs in blood for pharmacokinetic studies.
Tell me, what do you mean by a biomarker?
So a biomarker would be, for example, there isn't a good one for Alzheimer's, but for cancer, there are certain proteins that are good markers that a specific cancer is in the body. So a biomarker would be some molecule in the body or in the blood or urine that would indicate a disease or some sort of physiological state.
It wouldn't
state.
Be there in the absence of the disease.
Right, or it could be increased. I mean, it could be there, but not.
Ah, okay, so
I mean, a good
down.
Example of a biomarker actually is for heart attacks. They look at troponin and they look at creatine kinase to see if someone's had a heart attack. And those are at low levels, but they go up when someone has a heart attack, so they'll look.
But they're all post-impact.
Right.
I mean, you've got to have the heart attack.
Right.
There's no little marker that tells you you're getting closer and closer.
Right. I mean, that would be like the cholesterol.
Holy grail, right.
Yeah. And,
get Monty Python onto this.
Right. Exactly.
So tell us of the particular diseases that you're sort of interested in. Do you have a particular favorite type of disease, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, we look mainly at neurochemical diseases or neurological diseases. So we're really interested in Alzheimer's and stroke in particular. And our research does a lot looking at how inflammation can affect, or either stroke or Alzheimer's induces inflammation, or how inflammation can cause the damage you see with stroke.
What do you mean by inflammation?
When your body produces oxidative stress for a variety of reasons, it produces these compounds, reactive oxygen and nitrogen species. And so these species they're generated at a high rate in specific areas in the brain or in the arteries or in the blood vessels. And then they will react with the components of the blood vessels, the proteins on the blood vessels or in the brain, with the proteins in the brain, to modify them so they don't work right anymore. And so,
but again, this is post the activity, or is there a way that you can begin to monitor these in a sort of a more diagnostic, prophylactic manner, if I like?
Right. So what we're actually doing is more animal studies to look at how these are generated in the brain during, say, a stroke. So to get to the sort of microfluidics part, we have this technique called microdialysis sampling, where you can put a small probe in a variety of tissues, including the brain. And the probe acts sort of like a synthetic blood vessel. So basically it can deliver things to the brain or take fluid out of the brain, but it does it without actually removing fluid. So it's based completely on diffusion across the membrane. So you can sample for really long periods of time the extracellular fluid in the brain.
Okay, without actually sampling. It's just that there's enough migration from the blood fluid flow into your invasive
probe.
Process.
And so the fluid that you pump through this probe then goes into, you can either collect it offline in little vials and then analyze those using mass spectrometry or another method. Or what we've been trying to do is take that fluid and connect it to a chip so we can do near real-time monitoring of what's going on in the brain of the animal. And so we've developed some methods for monitoring multiple neuroactive compounds continuously in the brains of these rats and also sheep.
And sheep, too. That's a bigger animal than a little rat.
Right, well, because we're trying to make it with the sheep project, it's not so much related to disease, it's more related to behavior. And we've miniaturized the whole system so that we can do all of this via telemetry, so we don't have to actually have it like connected to anything.
Wait a minute. So I've got this image. Yeah. Let's go to the sheep.
Okay.
Big enough that I can imagine.
Yeah.
So on the head of the sheep, there'll be the whole little piece of equipment?
No. So that's what. Oh, that's
so
what
they're
that's
hooked
why we have
up
sheep.
To something.
So the actual device requires a power supply and some pumps. So it's about the size of a lunchbox. So basically, the sheep's on the instrument that runs it's on a backpack on the sheep.
Okay.
Then the probe is inserted into the sheep itself.
The thing is, though, it's all sheep can wander around.
Right, so that's what you want to do.
They don't seem to worry about this thing on their back.
Right, so sort of our holy grail, and we're not there yet, is to be able to monitor neurotransmitter release at the same time we're observing behavior. So if you think of the cameras you have like in a quick shop or something where it continuously monitors who comes in, who comes out. Well, if you could put a bunch of sheep in a pen and have those quick shop cameras and maybe put like in England, they always put those big red numbers on the sheep to tell which one's which. So you could just put something on there. Then you could correlate the telemetry information you're getting about neurotransmitter along with the behavior of the sheep. So if two sheep were eating, you could see it would have one set of neurotransmitters. If they were fighting or being aggressive, you'd see a different...
One has images of sheep, especially growing up in England.
Yeah.
You know, there's this famous hymn, sheep may safely graze, you know, talking about the flock, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's very bucolic, very beautiful. The green field and these little white dots all over it.
Right.
But then sometimes sheep get a little rambunctious.
Mm-hmm.
One of these, I can't remember his name, James Herriot.
Oh, right.
He was an author and a veterinarian,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote some beautiful, hilarious books about being a large animal veterinarian in Yorkshire.
Right.
But I don't think he died because of this, but he was in hospital for a long time because he was run over by marauding sheep.
Oh.
Just the concept of marauding and sheep never went together, but this is...
Well, apparently, when I first started this project, and I'm originally from Detroit, so I'm not a farm person at all, and I'm in Kansas, so I was thinking, oh, we should do this on cows, right? But apparently cows are more aggressive, and sheep tend to be pretty docile, but they're very social. So the social aspects will help, too, with looking at the neurotransmitters. But the idea is just to put this sort of backpack on there, and that's why we're not doing rats, is it's too big for your typical lab animals.
But, like all electronics these days, you're getting smaller and smaller.
Right, that's our hope, that we can get it to...
And then sooner you'll have something that sits on a cell, and you'll know everything that's going on inside the cell.
Right.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here talking with Susan Lunty from the University of Kansas, and we are talking about biomarkers and bioanalytical chemistry and sheep. We'll be back in a moment to continue the conversation.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. There's nothing quite like an ice cream cone or a slushy on a hot summer day until brain freeze. Ugh! Why does something so enjoyable come at the risk of such pain?
First, what most of us call brain freeze actually has another name that's a mouthful. Sphenopalatine ganglion neuralgia. No, that wasn't Emperor Palpatine. In the roof of your mouth, the palate, are many little blood vessels along with nerve fibers called nociceptors, which can detect painful or noxious stimuli.
The name nociceptors is derived from the Latin word nocio, which means hurt. The free ends of nociceptors in the skin, muscle, joints, bone, and organs convert pain stimuli into electric signals, which are then transmitted to the brain.
There are four kinds of skin nociceptors, some that respond to heat, to chemical substances, to mechanical stimulation like a pinch, and polymodal nociceptors that respond to high-intensity signals.
Well, that big bite of ice cream causes the capillaries in the roof of your mouth to constrict, and it happens so quickly that the nociceptors send a signal of pain to your brain.
In one study a few years ago, 13 volunteers were asked to drink ice water through a straw to ensure the water hit the palate. This caused a sudden dramatic rush of blood through an artery of the brain, raising the pressure in the brain and causing pain.
The rush of blood may be an effort to keep the brain warm, but the pain is also severe enough that most people stop eating their ice cream until it passes.
So what can you do about brain freeze? Drink warm liquid or push your tongue against the roof of your mouth to warm the palate. That should curb the pain so you can go right back to finishing your dessert.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Susan Lunty from the University of Kansas. Let's go back to the sheep because, you know, they are sort of docile.
Yeah.
But have you got any preliminary information yet?
Well, so far we have just... We've got the device developed, and we haven't actually done the brain studies yet because we're trying to make sure that it works well before we start doing brain surgery on sheep. So what we've been doing is looking at drug metabolism. So you can also put these probes peripherally in the sheep, and so we just...
What do you mean by peripheral?
Well, so you can put it underneath the skin
okay.
of the sheep. And so we were looking at transdermal delivery of nitroglycerin across the sheep's skin just to see if we could monitor... that remotely just to
okay.
prove that we could do it. And that way...
And where are you doing this?
I was at Purdue. They had
okay,
an animal.
Okay, so you got a sheep farm up there.
Yeah, and there's right. also one at K-State that we're going to start working with as well. Yeah.
All right.
An interesting thing about working with sheep is when you have this device in the lab, there's no noise, right? It works perfectly. It's great. And then you go into a barn, in a cold, musty barn, and try and get it to work. And you find there's a lot of things that you have to adjust and change to get it to work.
And, of course, you need to have the sheep in a social environment. It's
right.
just not one sheep by itself.
Right, right.
You
yeah.
need them all together doing what sheep normally do
right.
so you can see real behavior.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So what do you think in the end you're going to learn from this?
We wanted to look at basically social behavior. Well, one of the things that we were thinking about doing is looking at the peptide oxytocin, which is supposed to be a peptide. Actually, you can buy it on the internet now. But it's supposed to create bonding between the mother and the baby, but also it's supposed to create bonding between individuals.
Are you serious?
Yes, I'm serious, yeah. And so you can actually...
It's a supplement.
Well, it's a peptide that's actually used to induce labor, pitocin.
Okay.
But you can buy it on the web as an inhaler to actually...
And so, I mean, it's equally useful for males too?
Is this
only something that males have concocted to give to ladies?
I believe it's for both. I think the way they're so they found some other potential applications of it. There's been some literature that it might help with autism, and there's a couple other indications that pharmaceuticals...
But you can buy it now, though, on the web without
right.
a prescription.
Yeah. So
I'm very leery of these things.
Oh,
right?
yeah. yeah. No,
I mean, there's so many supplements out there.
Yeah.
Nobody controls
right, exactly.
the quality of the supplement. Nobody controls whether it actually works to do anything. It's a multi-billion-dollar scam
from my
point of view.
Well, actually,
I'm sure I'm wrong.
Just to second that, I was the editor of Analytical Methods, which is a journal, a Royal Society of Chemistry journal, and we get papers from all over, and a lot of the papers will be looking at supplements and what's in them. And depending on where you get them from, there can be a lot of heavy metals in those supplements that are be extremely dangerous. So the active component that you're looking for might be in there. But there might be a ton of heavy metals because the person that was growing this was growing it next to a sewage thing that was spewing out
a lot of pollutants.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we'll get carried away with this, but I think it's important because you're a scientist.
Right.
You're the editor of this journal doing specifically analysis of some supplements.
Right.
And then you discover that there's hardly any of the material, but a lot of other things. And yet it's still there.
Right.
All right. So you and the scientific community as a whole surely has an enormous responsibility to lay this open and get in touch with, in our case, the Food and Drug Administration, I suppose, and say, look, wait a minute, we've got to start to be much more careful about what we permit the citizens to go and buy over the counter.
Yeah, I agree. I know the Food and Drug Administration does look at some of the supplements, but a lot of them are under the USDA instead, because they're foods or food type products. But the worst supplements are if somebody buys them off the web, I think, because there you don't know where. In fact, just as a real aside, we have a senior analytical class at KU. And at the end of the senior analytical class, they have to do a project. And one of the projects actually was to look at a bunch of supplements that they got off the web for the active ingredient and for other things that were in there. And some of the things off the web are really scary. There's no active ingredient, and it's just full of harmful substances.
So, I mean, why is that not being addressed directly and immediately? America's full of people having lawsuits and class action suits.
Right.
Just to go for one of these companies and say, look, you gave me lead.
Yeah, I think because it's an international company and they're buying it off. They buy it off the web. It's shipped. This was shipped from, somewhere in Asia.
Let me push it a little further, Susan. What's your responsibility as an individual scientist with knowledge of this and an expert in the field? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you talk to whoever the senators are from Kansas? Would they even listen? But
actually, we have one Senator, Jerry Moran, that's pretty good about science and NIH and that kind of thing. But yeah, I haven't actually talked to them. I definitely talked to, colleagues, family members, things like that. But I haven't.
You have a bigger impact that you could make.
Right.
I mean, I'm not just you, but us in general.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, do you ever publish the results of these analyses, which show that supplement over here contains lead? I mean, I'm making this up, but lead, arsenic, but it doesn't have any of St. John's wort or whatever.
I personally haven't, but the journal has definitely published.
What about these little groups that you have in your own senior project?
Oh, well, they present posters on it, and then depends. Sometimes they'll present the posters. So it's four undergrads that put it together, but sometimes the TA that's working with them will present the results at a national meeting, or I've had some students present things at PitCon.
But you've never actually had them publish this in an appropriate location.
Yeah, they haven't put, because it's a short, I mean, it's not really complete. It's like a short.
No, but I mean, it's a complete analytical analysis of a particular bottle.
Right. Yeah. No, they
this
haven't
is it.
Done
I mean,
it.
I, we'll do another program on this in the future because, I mean, I find it really one of those things where the scientists know.
Yeah.
I mean, we unambiguously can say this set of supplements from this particular location are dangerous.
Right, yeah.
Then we should be exposing that. Scientists tend not to want to get out.
Right.
Right behind their laboratory environment.
Yeah.
But we have a responsibility.
Right, yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you agree.
I do agree. I definitely agree. I just... in that particular example, the students are definitely more aware of it, and hopefully, and a lot of them are pre-med, so hopefully they take that with them. But
we've got a few minutes left.
Yeah.
Apart from these ambulatory sheep with their backpacks, that you're monitoring, what other ideas of what other diseases or aspects are you looking at?
The other thing, so the one thing about microfluidics is that everything's really small volumes in the channels, and I guess you've had some other people talk about microfluidics, so the audience might know that. But so you only have a few microliters or nanoliters in the channel, so that's like less than one drop of water really in the whole device. And so one advantage of that is that you can analyze really small samples without diluting them. So one of the things that we do is single cell analysis. So you can basically bring a cell into the channel and lyse it and look at the contents of the single cell without really diluting it. So you can walk cells in one by one, lyse them, analyze the contents, then walk in another one. And so we're looking a lot at trying to determine these reactive oxygen and nitrogen species in immune cells to see You know, what makes them, what causes them to be produced, you know, do different things in the brain, beta amyloid, some other peptides, metalloproteases cause the production of these and in these immune cells, which would then start fighting the infection, but then also produce all the more.
Those are like natural killer cells.
Right, but they go haywire after a while, and then they start producing these species that wreck the proteins around the whatever it is that caused this initial inflammation burst. The reactive oxygen nitrogen species will then react with proteins in that area, and then they'll deactivate the proteins that'll kill the cell, and then it's sort of a cascade of events that could lead to neurodegeneration.
But, I mean, I was being facetious at the beginning, well, 10 minutes ago, when I said, you know, you've got the backpack on the sheep.
Right.
You'll make it small enough to go into a mouse, and then right. you'll be able to put it on a cell. Well, in a sense, yeah. you're bringing the cell to a bigger piece of equipment, but you're getting the same result.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, exactly.
And how long has that technology been out there? Five years, 10 years, three?
Cell analysis by chips, probably 10 years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's different methods. Like, we actually bring them in and lyse them and look at the contents. Other people will bring in cells and put them in an array or something and then do something to them and see what happens. So,
right.
But you can do things at the individual cell level.
And it can be done very quickly.
Yes.
You've got
lysed and you see the contents within a few seconds.
So you can collect an awful lot of data very quickly.
You can.
So in fact, as with many of the guests on Science Studio, the actual collecting of the data is
really
but
fast.
The analysis of it can take a lot longer.
Right.
And then obviously you've got to do statistical analysis mm-hmm. of, you know, the contents.
Right.
And so, you know, you can take months to analyze and seconds to collect.
Correct, yeah. The more data you get, the faster you get it. Now, fortunately, you know, computers and data analysis has gotten much more facile.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's
How close is your research to being more or less completely robotic?
I guess we're still wanting someone to be there to keep an eye
right.
on it. But to be honest with the sampling thing, if you were doing it on the – and we've done this before – if you're doing it on the bench, and since it's a method that doesn't actually extract any fluid, you can do the sampling for 24 hours, 48 hours. You could just let it run and then come back and get the data the next day.
That's
you're just always paranoid that something's
going to happen when you're not there watching.
And also, you know, anytime we do any sort of animal work, we always like to have the grad student there to make sure the animals, you know.
Hey, look, anytime you need someone to volunteer to go over and sit in the field and watch the sheep in England with all your robotics on top, you've got your man right
here. Okay, that's perfect. That's great. Yeah.
Susan Lunty, University of Kansas. It's been actually a pleasure, you know, chatting with you and talking about what you do, and good luck into the future. Okay?
All right, thank you. When I get my robotic sheep, I'll let you know.
Give me a call, right?
All right, thanks.
And I'd like to thank Lauren Tarasas for editing the program and producing the program, and you, the listener, for being out there. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.